That works, right? That works for me. That all works for me. It's fine.
One thing you have to know about Rabbi Penner is that I do a lot of question answers, and I sit on a lot of panels wearing my various different hats. So there isn't any question that you should feel that you shouldn't ask, even a very personal question, even a very family. As many of you know, we have a very interesting, colorful family, and that's a lot of what we try to share with, actually, people. So you shouldn't feel that any questions are out of bounds for you as well. I'm very happy to, whatever. If I can't answer it, then I'll say, you know, he's on.
Say it.
So, okay.
So, let's get started. Well, first of all, I just, Chevra, hello. My name is Matt Levy. I teach here a little bit.
Okay.
More than a little bit. Okay, fine.
But. So,
and probably our most biggest news is, Amir Tzashem, actually, part two to you, we're making Aliyah. We're making Aliyah.
That's it.
So that's... That's the future. The
right.
Video you sent out.
The video
I sent. Corona, you should know.
A lot of people made Aliyah because of that.
That was. So.
Okay.
All righty. Where did you grow up, Rabbi?
Where did I grow up? I grew up in Fairlawn, New Jersey. I was 5 years old when we moved to New Jersey. I lived in the Bronx of Pelham Parkway. I was one of the last Jews to leave Pelham Parkway. And we moved to Fairlawn. And I grew up in the shadow of Rabbi Yudin, who some of you know here from JSS, some of you know he's already retired from the shul. And many young men from Fairlawn went into the rabbinate in one way or another, having just lived in the shadow of Rabbi Yudin.
Okay. But where did you go to elementary school, high school?
Elementary school was Yavna Academy. Any Yavna graduates here? Yavna Academy in Paterson, New Jersey, which really takes it back pretty far. There were a lot of Jews in Paterson, New Jersey at that time. And then after going to Yavna, I went to Frisch. I interviewed at MTA with Rabbi Yitzchak Cohen. And Rabbi Yitzchak Cohen at that time was in all of his vigor and strength. And I was like, wow, it's scary to come to MTA. My gosh. So... In the end, I ended up really becoming a Talmud of Rabbi Cohen's because I went to Mar Shakolel, and he had a significant influence on my career trajectory and other things. I was in Mar Shakolel in 11th grade, but I was in Frisch for high school, and there established a lot of solid relationships.
So maybe you kind of just even alluded to this. Was there any like a defining moment where you realized, wait a second, I want to be in the rabbinate, I want to be a rabbi? Was there something?
I was a little bit of a strange young man, as I'm a strange older man now. I pretty much wanted to be a rabbi from the time I was about in 10th grade. Shul rabbi. I mean, part of it is when you grow up in Fairlawn, again, not you, this is the door asher lo yada es Rabbi Yudin, but if you grew up in Fairlawn, Rabbi Yudin and Chevy Yudin are the sort of the machlises of America. If you know the legends of the machlis family in Yerushalayim, the Yudins would have routinely 60, 70 people for Shabbos lunch. They had people move into their home for 9 months or 2 years at a time. Now, none of us thought we could do that, and his children, Rabbi Ruffwax and Chaviva, and his children who went into the rabbinate, nobody kind of does it that way. But if you grew up in Fairlawn, you kind of felt that Rabbi Yudin and Chevy are going to Olam Haba, for sure. And if you wanted to go to Olam Haba, there's like a path. I'm making it sound, I'm being facetious, but it's really not. In other words, growing up as a young kid, you just said you could either maybe get to Olam Haba, or like if you could just try to go do what they're doing, you saw these people that were so larger than life. So many of us sort of just assumed that we would go, you know, we would go into that. There were a couple of other stages. My bar mitzvah, I'm trying to think now.
My bar mitzvah
parasha, I remember getting up and practicing the speech on Friday morning in shul. Fairlawn's a pretty big sanctuary. The shul was already in what it is now. When I grew up in Fairlawn, it was what the Yudin house is, was the shul. And they eventually built this large shul across the street. And I remember after my bar mitzvah speech, giving the speech, and my father's on the other, it was an empty room, and my father's, I was just practicing on Friday morning, and I finished the bar mitzvah speech. And the first thing I said was, I like this. I can do this. I was a really strange kid. But I said, I was like a 13-year-old. That's what I said. I said, I like this. I can do this. Like, you know.
As a chutzpah.
So we had a couple. Probably, it's interesting, probably the biggest turning point for me was I come from a frum family, but I think like many kids, I was not particularly into frumkeit. And I wasn't particularly excited about it. I was involved in NCSY, which at the time in New Jersey was very involved with yeshiva kids and scandals. But at the time, we didn't know about the scandals. We knew about the yeshiva kids and this and that. So I became much more religious than my brother, for example. I have a brother who's very close in age, a wonderful fellow, not religious. And that sort of probably is where my trajectory would have taken me. He went from there to U of P, and he didn't, you know, just didn't, whatever. I was more involved in NCSY. And there was a particular thing that had happened. It's a funny story to share as a rabbi, but I think it's just interesting to see how you can, you know, change a kid's life. I was at a Shabbaton, and I was really, I had a really emotional, powerful experience in, like, somewhere towards the beginning of 10th grade. And the Shabbaton was very far away. I think it was in Englishtown, New Jersey. I was from Fairlawn. And I was supposed to leave Motzei Shabbos to go to a Sweet 16 back up, probably in Englewood or something like that. Nothing against Englewood, but I think that's where it was. And I remember they wanted me so much to go to the Shabbaton that they actually made sure to get me a ride to go back to the Sweet 16 after Shabbos. So after Shabbos, I was having some like sveikus. Like, should I go to the Sweet 16? Should I really? Whatever. And this was
coming from yourself. Nobody was like...
Well, I mean, you know, they were trying to brainwash me in general. Okay, but fine. Whatever, they were succeeding in general. It was working. I was more, you know, I was whatever. And someone made a very interesting call, because I kind of said, I don't know if I should go, I don't know if whatever. And my ride, who was an advisor, said, no, I really think that if you were committed to your friends that you should go, you should go. So they yanked me out of a Shabbaton to go to a Sweet 16.
Reverse psychology.
So I don't know if they knew that, they understood what happened. I walked into the Sweet 16, and I don't know what this was that was going on, but everyone was on the floor with their hands and feet up in the air, and there was like a lot of smoke. I don't know if this was a particular thing that people did. I didn't have a lot of Sweet 16 experience. But I walked in the room, and that was what was going on.
Okay.
And the contrast between where I had come from and where, after an hour-long drive, I stepped into basically changed my life. Wow. And I was able to kind of look square in the eye at two trajectories. Like, you rarely have that moment where you sort of see within 1 hour, I can choose this chevra and this whatever, or I can choose that. And I walked in, and it was just one of those moments that I just said, that's it. This can't be. I don't want to end up on my back on the floor with my hands and arms up in the air. That wasn't for me. And that really, I think, you know, pushed me very much in terms of frum. Again, I grew up in a frum family, but... Right. But like a lot of people, I'm like, whatever. It just wasn't whatever. And again, my brother, who's a wonderful fellow, who's not from today, was probably have been a similar that sort of trajectory. I think I had about 75 frish today as like, I don't know, God knows what, as you know, 250 students or something in a class. I had 75 students in my class, and I think 5 or 6 are from today, and that wasn't because they messed them up. That was. Most of the class wasn't
where
that from. to come in. So there's probably five or six who are from our whole chevra, and they're almost all in Rabbanus or Mechanchos. Basically, that's the chevra.
What yeshiva did you go to afterwards?
So I took an interesting path. So I was done with, so already in 11th grade, I went to Mar Shakolo. And at that point, and I was an oddity in Mar Shakolo. Because again, there weren't that many frish guys there. I was there with a Harvard sweatshirt and a little small pink yarmulke. And at that point, Mar Shakolo had a very right leaning, which it still does, kind of right, shticky leaning kind of thing. So I actually made t-shirts that said the MO Club, the Modern Orthodox Club, because like I needed to kind of like fit in there. I still am very friendly with the guys who like mocked me and all this and that, whatever, many of whom are learning in Lakewood now. So So Rav Cohen Shlita asked me 1 week, because he knew that I spoke a lot in NCSY, he asked me 1 week to give the Dvar Torah to the Kolo. And I, knowledgeable I wasn't at that point, after three whopping years of my frish education, knowledgeable I wasn't, but I could speak. Right. And I gave what I thought was a very good speech. I still remember what I said. I still remember the whole fort that I told her of Amital's idea about hearing the child cry, and if you can't hear the child cry, then what's your learning and all this and that. I spoke about going into Kiruv and stuff like that. And Rav Cohen pulled me over and said, Penner, said, you gotta learn. you gotta learn. This is a waste. He says, you gotta learn, you gotta stop doing all this stuff, you gotta learn, and then you're gonna teach Torah. So I did. I don't know. I was in a little pink yarmulke and a Harvard sweatshirt. And Rav Cohen said, like, this is just a waste. Like, you could speak. What are you doing? You know? So that was there. From there, I went to 12th grade. And then 12th grade, I was too busy in NCSY to learn, unfortunately. And then most of my Rebbeim were Talmidim of Rav Lichtenstein in the Gush. And I knew that if I went straight from Frisch to Gush, I probably needed 3 years to get to Rav Lichtenstein. And I chose to go to Gush, not that I don't love Gush, but I chose to go to Gush for only one reason, to learn by Rav Lichtenstein. That was the only, and it was probably the best decision I ever made in my life, other than the woman that I married, who's wonderful, and might be listening. So I knew that if I went straight, I probably would get yanked back to New York before I made it to Wilkinson's shir, and that was, I was only going to sit at his feet. Right. So I actually decided to stay for a year, and a couple of my friends did the same thing from Frisch. We stayed, we went to YU for a year. We went to Rovtorsky's shir. At that point, there was the first year that Rovtorsky was giving a college shir. Until then, he was giving the 12th grade. Can you imagine this? He was giving the 12th grade MTA shir. The 11th grade MTA shir. Sorry, no, in those days, MTA kids kind of went to YU for 12th grade. So he was given the 11th grade MTA year, and this was his first year he stayed with the boys into 12th grade. And it was basically like a freshman pre-Israel year. And he didn't know that we didn't know how to learn at all. Like, I had learned in Frisch like a whopping like six blot in 4 years. And he basically said to us that we're going to do a 90 blot Bekiyas in Shabbos, and then 60 blot, like, what is a blot? Like, what is he talking about? And that year was very remarkable in terms of my own growth, being by Rovtorsky. And from there, then went to the Gush. And was in Rabik's shir for a year, which was the Shana Gimel shir, and then to Rav Lichtenstein afterwards. And I've still never, even with all the gedolim here, I never had an experience quite like sitting at the feet of Rav Lichtenstein.
Something you can like.
His shir yomi was a masterpiece. It was any single shir. Like, you know, sometimes you go to like a shir, and it was like a shir, and you felt like, wow, whatever. Usually, as great as the shir yomi, like, they unfold over the course of the week, and you learn, but rarely do you walk out of just like a Monday afternoon shir feeling like, like, what just happened, right? That's what they say it used to be like in the Rav Shir. And that's what it was like. You feel that. I mean, I had the schus of learning from Shechter for many years, and you feel that after, for example, a Rav Shechter Kol HaChabur. Like, after Rav Shechter Kol HaChabur, you have that feeling like you heard something that you can't believe you sat through. So, but Rav Lichtenstein's two and a half hour Shir Yomi, which he only gave 3 days a week, fortunately, that was that experience of you felt that you had something had happened in the room, like something, like there was a revelation of Torah that was there. I remember once we had finished the first 10 blot in Kedushin, and he sat down at the top of his head and he tried to explain how every single sugya from Daf Beis through Daf Yud was all one chakira. And off the top of his head, he just rolled through it. I just, like, you know, it was truly a formidable experience. It was obviously out of my league at the time, but, you know, I encourage you to go out of your league. That's where you have to really push and grow. And, you know, and then already I came back to Rav Shechter, to Rav Rosenzweig. Was ready for that here.
Who were your roommates in Gosh?
So, Shana Aleph, well, I went a year late.
Okay.
So my Shana Bet roommate was my age, because he was already a year in front of me. I went a year late. But there was a guy named Ari Berman. Ari Berman was
the president of
YU,
oh,
yes.
Okay.
And we have a lot of incriminating photos of each other. We have the two of us kind of whatever. Let's just say we were both nice boys, but in a different place in our lives. But yes, and the other, one of my other chavrusas at the time was a guy named Josh Joseph, who just left over the last 2 years. But that was the gush. That was the chavra.
That was the chavra.
One thing that Rav Lichtenstein did was that he really pushed people to try to serve Klal Yisrael and to try to reach their potential of what. You know, that when I speak passionately at a Chag HaSmicha or something like that, I'm echoing, you know, what I heard from him, probably like on a Tainus Esther or, you know. Wow. He basically gave for many, many years exactly the same speech every Tainus Esther. Im HaCharesh, Tacharishi, Ba'es HaZos, Revach, Ba'atzalah, Yamod, Makom HaKher, Va'atu Beit Avich Toveta. Like, what did you do everything for, if not, you know. So that was... You know, and then once I was there, I was ready to be in Shechter's Shir and Rosenzweig's Shir, which, you know.
So, who is your Rebbe today? You have multiple Rebbeim? Who is
my Rebbe today? It's a good question. I don't think I have one Rebbe today. Especially because I'm here, I'm fortunate to have close relationships with a lot of my older Rebbeim. So whether it's Rav Twersky or Rav Willig or Rav Shechter or Rav Rosenzweig, you know, I'm fortunate to have that. The reality is that for a lot of things, for real family things, I'll go back to Rabbi Yudin, who just, you know, again, that's where we very much styled our lives, you know, after theirs. And then, because we have some special situations in our family, we've had to find people who could understand where we're coming from, you know, on a lot of those kinds of issues. So we did that as well.
Would you recommend for the Talmidim here, they should have a handful of different Rebbeim, or maybe
I don't know. I think I was always, and I'm still. It's funny because now I'm officially the boss. Rav Shechter calls me his boss, which makes me so incredibly uncomfortable. but I'm officially the whatever. I guess I am technically on paper if there's an organizational chart. So these gedolim are my staff or something like that, and it does make me, you know, very uncomfortable. But it makes me uncomfortable because I still am a person who is very, very intimidated by Gedolim.
Okay.
I don't think that I didn't take advantage in my years of the people that I was a dutiful Talmud. I was a Rosenzweig's note taker and the Shir. But I didn't take advantage enough time of bothering him and asking him advice. I didn't do that, and I should have. I had a few conversations with Rav Lichtenstein and with Rav Amital in the Gush, but it was chaval. I still remember every word of those conversations, which would make you think that if they were so impactful that I would have done it more. I just was too intimidated and too nervous, but that was a mistake because there's so much. I think the first Rebbe that I really connected with was actually Rav Neuberger, who's also very much a family rabbi for us. We used to live in Teaneck. In those days, the young couples didn't really live here unless you could duck very quickly. There were lots of bullets and other things going on. I mentioned to my future mother-in-law that we might live here and something about her over her dead body or something like that. So we moved to Teaneck. But the Kolo basically lived in Teaneck then.
Okay.
So I had for several, and Rav Neuberger was basically the ride in for a bunch of us. Now, if any of you are in Rav Neuberger's shir, now Rav Neuberger, you never know when he was going to come because he's always just too many things and too whatever. But that didn't matter. So for like two years, there was a small carpool of myself and Rabbi Yisrael Kamenetsky from DRS, who is just Yissi, my friend, and Rav Neuberger. So in those car rides, I think I got to talk to Rabbi Neuberger in a way that I was didn't access my other Rebbeim quite as much. And I think that was something that I certainly would have done more of.
And you would encourage the Chevron to find that Rav to ask you.
To find the Rav or even not find the Rav. In other words, just but take advantage of the opportunities. Just because the Rabbanim aren't necessarily coming to you and saying, can we have lunch? It doesn't mean that they don't want to make time. It doesn't mean that they're actually not happy to make time and excited to make time when a Talmud wants to come and talk. It's just not easy to do that later in life. And those conversations, I think, are very, are very kedai.
If we could just take a quick step back, how do you be the boss of Gedolim?
Very gently. Very gently. The good thing is here that most of this is a system. So I don't have to. There are things going on now. We had a discussion with the Rebbeim. Some of you may have heard this from your Rosh Yeshiva, that we're trying to get the Rosh Yeshiva to spend a little more time giving shir, whether that's shir yomi or whether that's parsha. The feeling is that if there's 9 to 2:30, that, we feel, myself, Rabbi Kalinsky, and others who really spend a lot of time around the yeshiva and around different shiurim, that it wouldn't be bad if there was a little more, I hate to say instructional time, but time of receiving Torah from the Rosh Yeshiva than just from the Svarim. And that can be uncomfortable when you're advising people who you usually go to for advice, on those kinds of things. But I think that what makes it easy is I think everyone here, despite the fact that you hear a lot about the politics and this and that, really, there's a tremendous desire that you guys should learn Torah and that the yeshiva should succeed. So this, in terms of, obviously there are certain different hashkafic things in here and there, but derech klal, everyone just wants there to be more Torah and for the guys to learn and to learn better and to learn at a higher level. So there really is, I think, a trust in that sense that, whatever we're doing, we're trying to bring together. Fortunately, most of the Rosh Yeshiva, other than Rav Shechter, doesn't call me their boss. Rav Shechter is a poel. He won't take off unless he asks permission. And I always say, I said, what does Rav Shechter think he should do? I don't know. I don't know. But he's a poel. He's such a tzaddik that he doesn't take liberties with his job description and this and that. And he, if, you know... Yeah. He at the Chag HaSmicha, he was missing from the dancing after the Chag HaSmicha. And I tried to find out what happened. Where's Rav Shechter? And it turned out that Kol Seder had started, and he felt that, I'll pee his contract, he needed to be in the Beis Medrash with the Kol Seder. Now, the Rebbetzin had a few words for him about that later, but I just spent a week on a bus with them in Eretz Yisrael going around, for those of you who saw the pictures from the Shemitah trip, so I'm very holding in the whole thing. But, all I can say is, learning, being around these individuals on a day-to-day basis is just a very inspiring. I'm very lucky. You guys are supposed to be in yeshiva at your age. It's still a schus to be in yeshiva, but you're supposed to be in yeshiva at your age. When you're my age, you're not supposed to be able to be in yeshiva. When I'm here Yom Kippur, Like, you're not supposed to be able to have a Yom Kippur, a yeshiva davening for Yom Kippur when you're in your 50s. That's just not something that you should be able to access, right? So it's just very lucky to be able to come to this place as a workplace. Usually when you come to a workplace, it's like sort of taking you away from, you know, you come from Shacharis and then you go to work and then you go back and you try to have a little Meir of a Night Seder. And like when I come to work, I'm coming to yeshiva. So it's just, it's an amazing, it's a great life if it works out to be able to do something like that.
What are you learning right now? What's your lingua?
I have charusas with many family members. I don't have the... I do have a couple of other charusas.
Okay.
But they're... I don't have any charusas for me right now. When I was a shul rabbi, I had a lot of charusas in the shul. I think that one of the biggest chasadim that you can do for somebody is to learn with them. So, different people who are down on their luck... you offer to learn with them 15 minutes a week, 20 minutes a week. It's like life-changing for their experience. So that I still do. I learn with a whole bunch of my family members. My father, which is the biggest chus that I have to learn. And my father, he's in Florida now, but you know, before COVID, you'd see us on Sundays in the Beis Medrash.
What do you learn?
There we're learning Tur Beis Yosef, Hilchos Shabbos. I'm still trying to convince him that he can do smicha. He's nervous about the deen. He doesn't know if he wants to go into it. But trying to do that. Personally, I don't know if any of you have seen me with my strange sheets. I have been for 10 years now. I've been working on a system to sort of collapse Shas into a more bite size. Basically working with the original text of the Gemara and then taking out certain pieces so that I can get the flow of the Gemara, but I can do it much more quickly. So I've been doing that since the last daf cycle. So now this time I'm layering in Tosfos and the Rush and things like that. So that's a lot of time every day. I find that if you find a way of remembering, if you find some system for remembering what you're learning, then it's much more, it motivates you to keep doing it because you don't feel like it's just going, I'm not blessed with a memory. Not that, you know, I just can't. I have colleagues here and I have friends who just, they could learn, they just learn through the Masechta and they just remember the Masechta. I have two children like that. Doesn't work that way for me. But, you know, they say that, it says, the Gemara tells us in several places that Ashri Misha Bolakan v'Talmudo b'yado. So what's Pshat Talmudo b'yado? So the Marsha says Talmudo b'yado, it's a very important Marsha. Marsha says that the final exam is an open book test. Open book, open notes.
Open notes.
It's open notes. So he said, you get your final exam in Shemayim, you get an open notes. So my goal is that I should have Shas and Poskim in my notes. And it'll be a little easier. I may have to say, hold on a second while I flip through it. But that's sort of the goal. And the rest of my time, as many of you know, is spent on tefillah, writing a several volume book on tefillah in English, mostly about kavana and the experience of tefillah, and it's frustrating. It's hard to write, but that's the rest of the time is mostly tefillah stuff and researching for the sefer.
Transitioning more maybe from you into like the yeshiva b'gadol, what do you think is the main avodah for the students here? What's the avoda? What's like to become a better Talmud? To become, specifically here at YU, what would you say is?
I don't know if I could point to one, but there probably are several things that I think someone's trying to really get out of the experience here. First of all, more than pick, I know it's hard because we live in a generation that's about picking up knowledge and about bakiyas and about finishing things. But you really only have one opportunity to learn how to learn. And you may have started that in Eretz Yisrael. If you're really exceptional, you may have started that at the end of high school. But you really only have one opportunity to learn how to learn. And that's probably never going to happen once you're out of here. You could spend many, many hours learning.
Right.
But in terms of understanding how you approach a Gemara, how you build a sugya, how you go from a Gemara to a halachic maskana, you can't really get that outside of Shimush Tamiri Chachamim and outside being here. So it's hard, because it's hard sometimes. One of the things we're actually meeting with the Rosh Yeshiva about is, how do we give you fellows a sense of geschmack for advancing in your learning when it can't be counted in the number of daf that you finish? Not that we're against Bekiyas. Again, most of my limud now is Bekiyas, right, doing a blot a day with all the Rishon, whatever I can cover, and so I'm all for covering ground. But how can we give you tools to measure that you're growing in Iyun? That's hard. But if you don't feel that geschmack, if you can't say, I now know how to learn better than I did before, when you get to Shana Aleph, you always feel like that, because it's not hard to feel different when you couldn't read something and now you can read it. But at your level now, as you're going further into that, how do we give you tools to realize that, oh, now I can actually make sense of a ritva now. I actually get what a Tosfos is trying to do. So that's one thing I think that's really key. And again, that's not, you know, it's hard sometimes to feel that, but this is the chance to do that. This is the chance to do that. You want to soak in information, you want to do that, you'll get to do that for the rest of your life.
Right.
Your patience as a 30-year-old learning Night Seder in your friend's living room when their newborn is crying, your patience to do like a Reb Chaim there is going to be a lot less. That's where you're going to learn Bekiyas and you're going to whatever, but you're going to learn how to read a Gemara. Like from a Rosenzweig's shiur, I don't remember the particular hakiras, but I'll never be able to look at a Gemara the same way again. There's a certain way of thinking about the way the thing progresses that you just do it enough times and then you just kind of see everything. And that's something I don't think you can gain by just spending more time as an older person. The second thing is the sense of balance. You know, and that's probably the most important thing for the rest of your lives, is to be able to balance, you know, your parnasa and a busy schedule with the ability to learn. And a lot of guys really do succeed. I was talking recently to a graduate of Reitz, a graduate of Smicho, who's in an accounting firm. And he says, very interesting, it's a very frum accounting firm. And frum meaning basically why you enter right. I guess that's frum. Not so much to the left of why that's that from. But basically, you have YU, and you have a lot of Lakewood guys, and you have a lot of this and that. And he said that the Mincha Minyan and the 10-minute shiur and all kinds of stuff like that is always organized by the YU guys in the firm, who didn't learn as long as their Lakewood counterparts, who all learned until basically they were 30 and then they came in. And he was trying to figure out why, because these are guys who knew as much as they knew. And he said that for a lot of the fellows who just did learning till they were 30 and then introduced work, it was very hard to mesh the two. It's like, now I'm working. It doesn't mean I won't have a night seder when I get home, but these hours, I'm working. And this idea of needing to chop a rein to learn for 10 minutes, you don't have that if you're learning all day and all night.
Right.
For your whole developmental experience, which is great in a certain way, you don't have the appreciation for what 10 minutes of learning is. You don't have that thing of sneaking in a Mishnah and opening it and trying to chop a rein and trying to get a Mishnah in. But if you're in a situation where you are balancing and you appreciate that learning two Mishnayos, you'll finish Mishnayos in 7 years, then you sort of seize these opportunities even while you're working and even while you're in the middle of things. And that's something that you can gain out of the, as chaotic as it is. I mean, we're all chaotic. None of us slept, none of us, that was always the...
I'm going to open it up to questions.
Sure.
Just a moment. I'll say one thing. Next week, Mirza Shem, the Sarim says it's going to be open.
Ah.
And maybe you've already told us that we need to start getting into our Pnei Rishuyos or Ritva, whatever it is. But is there a certain sefer that maybe you're interested in? Or, say it like this, something that you think that the guys should be aware of? Hey, you should know.
Well, those of you who are not, I don't know if any. In fact, I can barely see these days. I'm about to have cataract surgery soon.
Oh, yeah.
So I can tell one or two people here. I can see faces. But I don't know if anyone here is also, though maybe one in the back. I don't know. I can't actually see faces right now. But in a few weeks, I'll be able to see without glasses. It'll be great. I have this one sefer that I do on Wednesdays at 6 o'clock here. I have a chabur in Da'as Tfila. Da'as Tfila is a life-changing, absolutely life-changing sefer, which all of my Tfila stuff originally really comes from there. It's a sefer that's this thick that doesn't get into a single word of Tfila.
Who's the
Mechaber is Rabbi Ehud Rakovsky Avitzedek, who lives two streets up from Gross. On Rehov HaRafrank in Beit Vegan. Unfortunately, he's not well. He was a Talmud Muvik of Ramosha Shapiro Zatzal. And he wrote a number of Sfarim. Das Tfila, Das Shabbos, Das Emuna. They're not easy Sfarim. They're absolutely mind-blowing. They're just mind-blowing. You just feel like the world just comes together when you see that. So those are treats. You, in addition to Sfarim that you struggle through, you also need Sfarim that you really just enjoy, you know, reading, and that you can, you know. I never really learned Tanakh, even in Gush. I tried to learn Tanakh in Gush. I had no skills. I remember once sitting down with a friend of mine, and I was reading a pasuk from Hosea or something. I don't know. And I was just sitting him at lunch, and I was like so frum that I was talking different Torah at lunch. And like I said to this guy who I went to Frisch with, I said, this is such an interesting pasuk. And he looked at me like, and he said, do you remember we learned that in 10th grade? And I'm like, I don't know what sefer we learned that. I can't name anything. So that's where I was in Tanakh. When I came to my shul in Holliswood, there was an afternoon, instead of an afternoon Gemara shir, there was an afternoon Tanakh shir. And I was much, much younger than the previous rabbi, and it was kind of understood that I was supposed to just give all the shiurim he was giving from the pasuk that he left off. So I picked up this shiur in Shmuel Aleph, and we learned through Nehemiah in 20 years.
Wow.
20 years Nehemiah, to the point that it was my favorite shiur of the whole week. I spent 5-6 hours a week preparing this shiur in Tanakh, and I would I would get emotional during shiur. I would cry during the shiur. Like Tanakh is really, so I think that's something we shouldn't miss. That there's a tremendous amount of emotion and power and things in Tanakh. When we all learned Tanakh in high school, if you had the tremendous chus of being in yeshiva high school, so you basically worked on reading, right, Ma'ari Karaz and Radax and whatever, and that's not what it's meant to be. I remember the first time I gave a Tanakh shiur, I was the assistant rabbi at Lincoln Square. And they asked me to give a something. So I said, I'll teach Yeshayahu. Why not? The fact that I didn't know it was in Yeshayahu. I should have probably opened the book before I agreed to teach it. So I learned enough to know that Yeshayahu really starts in the sixth parak. So I started with the sixth parak. And I had 8 people in the first week. And then 4. And then 2. And then like this one lady said, Rabbi, I mean, like, I just feel bad. But, you know, and it was awful. It was really awful. And the reason why it was awful, because I was teaching it the way I learned in high school, which is you read a pasuk, and then you do the 5 different mefarshim on that pasuk.
Rashi, Malbi.
Exactly. And whichever one of them was right, the text was not meant to be dissected in 5 different ways, stopping after every pasuk. The way I learned to teach Tanakh is that if you have 2 mehalchim, you'll learn the parak twice. First, you follow the whole, and the stories are dramatic.
Right.
Stories in Tanakh are unbelievable, but not if you stop every pasuk and read every possible explanation about that pasuk, and you forget what you're up to. They were meant to be read as narrative. They were written to be narrative. So read it first, just read it, and then read it with Rashi, and then read it with Radak. Don't break up the story to do that. I once heard someone do that. We had Professor Uriel Simon from Hebrew University. Is he still alive? Anybody know? Is there 6 months still alive? I can't imagine. When I was assistant rabbi, he is. Wow. So I had Rav Uriel Simon, changed my whole thing of Tanakh with this. He came to Lincoln Square. I was like the head of the adult ed, whatever. So I had him come in. I didn't know who he was. They said he was a nice guy. I didn't know anything about anything. Who is Professor Uriel Simon? He came in. He gave a share on Yiftach and his daughter. Friday night. Not a good slot to speak. After dinner, Friday night. And it was the first time I had ever heard someone tell a story in Tanakh as a dramatic story,
right,
with a mahalach rather than stopping and talking. And I'd never heard anything like that. I basically knew the story of Yiftach and his daughter, but like it never to me was a riveting story. And I'm like, this is the most exciting story I've ever heard. And then I began to realize that there's a very different way to do that. So there are fascinating stuff on Tanakh, the stuff that Magid is coming out now with on Tanakh. The books of Rav Yaakov Ariel from Ramat Gan. He has a son who's the chief rabbi of Nov. Nov, famous from Tanakh, named Yigal Ariel. So Yigal Ariel has about 7-8 books in Hebrew on Tanakh, where he actually weaves in Chazals and tries to tell you what they were really trying to get at in a frum way. But trying to explain, like, what is the Medrash really trying to say when it says that such and such happened? And that's brilliant, brilliant stuff. And also, and you'll take this from my word because I'm a Gush guy, the Rav Rivlin from KBY. If a Gush guy says wonderful things about KBY, so you have to make sure it's very serious. Who Rav Rivlin, who was the Mashkiach for many years in KBY, I think still is.
Yeah, I think he is.
His books on Tanakh are absolutely tremendous. His book on Megillas Esther, if you can get Hanistarim Be'Esther, is the best thing I've ever seen on Megillas Esther. It's really, so I don't know if you can get those at the farm sale. Probably have to get them from KBY.
We'll open it up to the Olam.
Okay.
If people have any, I don't know how much more time
we'll take one
have.
Or two questions, yeah.
We'll take a couple, yeah.
Yes. Neighbor, how are you?
I remember you saying...
That's right next to me, yeah.
Okay.
I remember you saying 2 years ago, you were here for Shabbos, you said that you couldn't imagine your kids sitting in a classroom in Hawaii the same way we did that. In COVID, that totally changed, and we were in a futuristic sense. What do you think,
right,
looking back at that prediction?
It was my grandkids. Kids are already...
That's right.
Right, my kids are already done with college, except for one little guy. I still think that's a probably fairly reasonable thing. Things are changing so quickly. I made that prediction before COVID. I think COVID sped it up a lot. My granddaughter, my oldest granddaughter now is 6. It's hard to believe that when she's 18, she'll be in like a half desk in Stern with a regular whiteboard and whatever. It just, I don't know, things are changing very, very quickly. I think that Torah learning, because of the dynamic of a chavrusa, and because of the Rebbe-Talmud relationship, will likely not change nearly as much, and I hope it doesn't. But I think that the way that we approach college learning will probably continue to shift. And I think you'll probably see why you make some changes over the coming years, whether you'll see it in the next 2 years or the next couple of years. But, you know, I think that a lot of that is changing. I think people don't, for the most part, pick up knowledge in a classroom anymore. They have an experience. And there's some colleges where it's really an experience, where you're sitting in a room and you're not hearing a lecture, you're engaging in a round table. That's not most college classes, and that's not most colleges. But I think that the way people just get volumes of information, I think, is just changing very, very quickly now. And to the extent that one is going to college to pick up information, I think that that's going to have to change, you know, along with that. But we'll see. That was before COVID, and COVID, you know, sent it through the roof. I don't know. We'll see. Other questions? Yes?
So, in general, right, you spoke a lot about why you mean like yeshiva. It's an issue of balance.
It's like a yeshiva.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I think it is yeshiva, actually. Yeah.
How do you think... Okay.
Yeah.
No, so I mean, do you think that what you sent to the Talmidim is like, let's try to maximize yeshiva, and, you know, like you said, any 5 minutes we can to slip back from Mishmadish we showed, let's do the minimum amount of work we can, anything else, and let's try to basically live as if we were in Lakewood and also...
You know, yeah, no, don't misunderstand me to say that. I don't think that's true. I think that if you're here for college, you should get as much out of college as you can, and everything you're doing in, you should do it 100%. I'm not a fan of... I think that it develops bad midos, actually, to take anything not seriously. It develops also bad habits in terms of that. So no, I don't think that it means that you're not studying for an exam and instead you're opening up the Mishnah for 5 minutes. But the point is that as opposed to a friend who has all of the afternoon to learn as well, I think that here there's more of a stress to chop, to try to get that in, to try to do that. You know, the loss of afternoon seder is a big deal, you know. And I think it makes sense. It makes more sense to do college for most people than to do afternoon seder in the Beis Medrash. But I think there is something. But yeah, it shouldn't be understood to mean, you know, that... Because again, it's a waste to go to college. If you're going to college, you should get as much out of college as you can get. Obviously, some classes are going to be more valuable than others. But I still think that, you know, that sense of sort of walking around with a piece of paper, you know, I'm notorious. President Joel, Priest-President, used to make fun of me. I'd like run into a lot of things on campus because I'm always holding those notes for the last 10 years. You know, what really killed me was when they put the big things, they blocked off the plaza. That used to be just like an open place to come.
Right,
so they put these big yellow things.
Yeah, the gates.
I can't tell you how many times I have walked into those yellow things, which is better than walking into a pole as far as glasses are concerned and stuff like that. But that is a constant problem that I'm hitting those yellow bars. But you're only here for so long, and there's so much to learn. There's so much to do. So. Yeah, but thank you for clarifying that. No, I'm not suggesting that.
Let's get one more question. Is there anything that you think doesn't get enough focus or conversation or attention amongst YU students and Talmidim that should get more of that?
You know, the biggest thing I would probably say is tefillah. I think that's typical in yeshivas. Rav Pinkus, in the introduction to the Sharm Bat Tefillah, you know, says that if a guy comes into Shana Aleph in yeshiva and when he's Shana Gimel, he's at the same level of learning, he would assume he's a failure. But if a guy comes in Shana Aleph and he's at the same level of tefillah at Shana Gimel, it doesn't even bother him. So that shouldn't be that way. So, you know, I think that's one thing I would say, is that this has to be a real time of growth in tefillah. I'm very tefillah oriented, but I think that's in many ways a key way of having a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The second thing I think that's I'm gonna end by sounding old and cranky old, but I think that most of you have grown up into a Jewish society where a lot of things already are established. And that doesn't mean that you're derelict in not creating new things, but it means you've never experienced the thrill of creating new things and running things yourselves. And part of that is our fault, because like, we're involved, I'm not involved anymore, but I used to be involved like in the Shabbos programming here, you know, and that's silly, because I was remembering when I was your age, I was running 500 person Shabbatons. I wasn't having someone 15 years older than me running a Shabbos program. But I think so much has been established already, and the community is so established, and there's so much there for you, that I don't know if you get the thrill of wanting to go out and change the whole world. I think we felt that much more, because there was just much less out there. There's a meeting on the sixth floor now about this whole Shemitah trip. One of the reasons why we did the Shemitah trip was to give a very small group of guys the opportunity to just like change the lives of 100,000 people. And it's very exciting. And I think we have to be committed to figuring out how to open up those kinds of doors to you guys and let you do it. But I don't think there's as much of a thrill of being young and a thrill of what you're going to accomplish and what you're going to change. I think it's much more of a survivor mentality. Maybe that's also due to the economy and due to the stresses of all this and that. But I think we felt that a lot more. And not only in Torah, in medicine, in law, in, you know, it was sort of, you know, we were here to go and change the whole world. And, you know, we didn't change the whole world, but I think it was thrilling to try to do some of those things. So, okay.
Can I push you on one last thing?
Very quickly, yes.
Very quickly. We should end with some Divrei Torah. I once heard you say that you can take any Rashi in the Parsha and turn it into a whole word.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to challenge you to do that right now.
Here's the whole Rashi. Tell you, I try to do one Aliyah a day. It's convenient that there are seven Aliyahs. So we're holding by like, I didn't do review today. It's Chatayani Maskirayim. Yeah, any Rashi can be made into a... I have to read it?
What if I don't know. Maybe you don't
Rashi
have to do
says,
that.
Rashi says that by the... Rashi says by the lulaot, right? So there's basically the whole tapestry on the top is divided into two big pieces. They sewed them together. They were made in strips and they were sewed together, but they came in two. And then each thing had a little loop on the end. There were 50 loops, and there were 50 copper like hooks that held the thing together.
Clamps.
So those are called makbilot. Makbilot in the Parsha.
Okay.
Ulaot makbilot. So why are they called makbilot? Right? To accept, to receive. The word makbilot, Rashi explains, means to be exactly across from somebody. So why is the word lekabel synonymous with being across from somebody? Right? And while I don't know exactly where to go with it yet, there's a profundity in that idea of first taking your place as an equal with somebody, first lining yourself up with somebody, and then being able to be mekabel, right? In some way or another. This is not the easiest parsha.
This is a tough parsha.
To take
this
every... No, the Rashis are not so hard, but they're descriptive.
Right.
They're descriptive Rashis, right. So they tell you amazing things. The construction of the Mishkan, those hooks were right overhead. They looked like stars. Right? I don't know if you realize this, but the top of the Mishkan was mostly, they had a lot of tcheles in there. And those hooks, the Gemara says in Shabbos, I think, looked like stars in the sky. So from the outside, the whole thing was one big black cover. It was one big goat skin, which was just totally ugly. And on the inside, it was one of the most beautiful things that you'd ever seen. And probably the reason why that was is HaKadosh Baruch Hu was telling Klal Yisrael that Shechora Aniva Na'ava, that at this early stage, right, because eventually the Beis HaMikdash was openly beautiful. And at the beginning, the Mishkan was incredibly beautiful on the inside, but it was covered with this thick layer of goat skin. And what HaKadosh Baruch Hu was saying is, that's the way I see you. You see yourselves as dark skinned. Dark skinned in those days was always very bad, right? Not because of prejudice, but because if you had dark skin, it meant you worked in the field. Shechora ani v'na'ava, the woman says in Shir HaShirim. I am dark, but I'm still pleasant. That wasn't anything to do with being dark. Dark meant suntanned. If you were suntanned, it meant you were the lower class. People had very, very pale skin, the Mona Lisa, if you were inside all the time. So what HaKadosh Baruch Hu was saying to them is, I know that you think that you're very dark on the outside because you've been working as slaves all these years, but I can see this beautiful inside. So he actually created the Mishkan in the form of Klal Yisrael, and they're coming out of the thing. Once they got to Eretz Yisrael, there were beauty on the outside, just like they were on the inside. So just understanding the symbolism of the Mishkan is really unbelievable. Okay, everybody.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Shkaya. I'm going to ask you any questions. Sorry, my wife's
going to ask. Okay. I mean, I didn't know.